It was an ordinary work day in Memphis and Thebes and Babylon. It passed entirely unnoticed. But in the far reaches of the Sinai wilderness, Moses and the children of Israel were binding themselves to the Torah covenant. The businessmen and workmen of Jerusalem and of Rome went about their business, quite unaware and unaffected by the execution of Jesus and of a few common criminals. 100 years ago this year, Londoners hurried about their business, quite unaware of the fact that Karl Marx had, on one particular day, pushed back his chair from his desk at the British Museum, having written the last sentence of his new scripture, Das Kapital. The great religions of the world were all born in silence and in anonymity. But once they grab hold of the hearts of men, they shake the entire body politic. Now, despite its official anti-religious doctrine, communism is the most spectacularly successful of all new religions. One third of all the people of the world live in states in which communism is the official religion. One third of all the children of the world recite daily in their schools the catechism of this new faith. There are communist parties in every nation on the face of the earth, either legal and visible, or illicit, hunted. 100 years, communism has moved from a vision, an economic vision in the eyes of a London dreamer, to the living faith of a good proportion of mankind. Now, it is one of the commonplaces of religion. They are born in silence and in distant places, but that they flourish in public and in the centers of the world, the power centers of the world. Judaism was born in the Sinai Peninsula and it flourished in Judea. Christianity was born in Judea, Judea broken under Roman rule, but it flourished in Rome. Communism was born, if you will, in Western Europe, and Marx confidently expected the communist revolutions in the more advanced states of Western Europe. But it has flourished in the Soviet Union, where 50 years ago this week, the Bolsheviks brought off their successful November Revolution. And it is to this day in Moscow that the authority and the ceremonial of the communist faith is centered. Communism is a faith, on this I insist. There's a scripture, Das Kapital, has a gospel, the Communist Manifesto. It has its patriarchs, Marx and Engels. It has its lawgiver, Lenin. It has its priesthood, the commissars. It has its truth, Pravda, and its heresy, deviationism. It has a messianic complex, and it has an active missionary apparatus which exists in every part of our globe. Like all the great histories, like all the great religions of mankind, communism has its doctrine of man. Man is more a product of nurture than of nature. Man is a product of the conditions of the economic system in which he is found. In a system of class antagonisms, man is necessarily suspicious and defensive and aggressive. But come the classless society, man will mature into his own fullness and he will be peaceful and fulfilled, untroubled, unconflicted, happy. And like all the great religions of mankind, communism has its philosophy of history. History, according to the communist doctrine, is a product pure and simply of economic forces. With the coming of the Industrial Revolution, more and more power was concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people. They controlled the capital, which in turn controlled the means of production. The workers were increasingly subordinated to the privileged, but they increasingly recognized that without their labor, the privilege could not survive, the capital could not be increased. Dimly sensing their power, the workers of the world would turn to those who could give them strong guidance and discipline, the elite of the Communist Party. There would be revolution. There would be a forced march period of economic growth and consolidation, all under the tyranny, the dictatorship of the elite. But then in time, after the economic revolution had been won, that dictatorship would wither away. According to Marx, the state exists only to maintain the privileges of the privileged and to maintain those who are underprivileged in their want. And once all people have all that they can expect and hope of the society, there is no reason for a state, and to use Lenin's phrase, it will wither away. The communist worker then will have not only economic advantage, but political freedom. I'm often reminded as I listen to or read the communist publications of the messianic statement of faith of our own people. I believe in the coming of the Messiah, even though he is delayed, I await him confidently. Even though the withering away of the bureaucracy, of the tyranny is momentarily delayed, the communists say, I await its withering, its disestablishment, when in addition to social welfare, I will enjoy political freedom. So communism is a faith. Like all faiths, it has its zealots, and its doctrine, its catechism, its dogma, its priesthood, its messianic concept. It has had in its history all of the classic problems which have affected the classic religions of mankind. Delegates from 100 or more nations of the world are assembling in Moscow to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. And interestingly, they themselves will be confused by exactly what it is that they are celebrating. The growth, the tremendous economic, political growth of the Soviet Union, or the triumph of the Internationale, the triumph of the Communist Party. For increasingly, it is evident that the two are not synonymous. There are already Protestant groups within the communist faith system. Not only Peking, but Albania, Yugoslavia, Cuba, and many of the communist parties in outside the Iron Curtain in the so-called free nations of the world. I believe that the 50th anniversary celebration going on this week is far more a triumph to the renaissance of the Russian state. It is a statement of the success of the communist faith. For although the giant picture of Marx will dominate Red Square, it will be paralleled by an equally giant picture of Lenin. And it will be Russia that is on display, rather than the worldwide revolution which the Marxists so confidently expected. It will be the Russian army which will march into Red Square with its 3.5 million troops, its sleek, sophisticated modern weapons, dragging along with it its rockets and missiles, the spaceships which have shot the cosmonauts to Venus and beyond. It will be the visible and the no less real and tangible achievements of the Soviet Union which will be prated about. Let none of us forget that these are many and they are great. 1917, before the Bolshevik Revolution, 3 in 4 Russians were illiterate. 4 million Russians only were in school. Less than 125,000 Russians were in the university. Today, 95% of the Russians are literate. 50 million Russian children are in school, and 4 million Russian young adults are in universities or technicums in advanced education. In 1917, the Soviet Union produced 2 billion kilowatt hours of electricity. In 1967, she will produce 584 billion kilowatt hours. In 1917, the Soviet Union produced 4 million tons of steel. In 1967, the Soviet Union will produce 104 million tons, 80% of American production. This year, the Soviet Union will produce 8.1 billion meters of textiles, 4.7 million television sets, 4 million refrigerators, an almost equal number of washing machines. In 1917, the Soviet Union was the fifth largest industrial producer in the world. In 1967, she is second only to the United States. And it must be remembered that she has had this tremendous growth, despite jolts to the economy, unlike any which we suffered in the intervening period. She has suffered tyranny, its viciousness, and its foolishness. In 1936 and 37 and 38 alone, some 7 million Russians were put to death under Stalin, and she suffered 5 years of violent and cruel invasion by Germany during the Second World War. Russia lost 20 million citizens, men, women, and children, in that war. And despite tyranny and despite invasion, 50 short years, she has moved by forced step and up her position until she is now the second great power in our world. And this achievement has not been done without great cost, of course. Standard of living of the Russian people has constantly been sacrificed to production and industrial development and armaments. It is estimated that the standard of living of the average Russian is 1/4 of the standard of living of the average American. Just this year, in honor of the 50th anniversary of the revolution, the Russian worker will finally be granted a 5-day week. But despite the sacrifices which the Russian people have had to make, despite the human cost which has been imposed upon them by their tyranny, they have come a long way quickly, and they seem to be pleased and prideful of their achievement. For the Bolshevik Revolution was not only an economic revolution and not only a communist tyranny, but it opened up, it ripped apart the seams of Russian society and permitted those on the bottom to stream up into position and opportunity. In 1917, Russia was a highly stratified society. You died as you were born, a peasant, a serf, a muzhik, a Jew, whatever you were. There was no movement into the very narrow upper classes of the church or of the state. All this disappeared in 1917. And with education as their ladder, young Russians from all over Russia climbed into the areas of opportunity in education, in politics, in agriculture, and industry, which fast opened up to them. The last 50 years have seen the emancipation of women in the Soviet Union. In 1917, women belonged in the house. Today, 75% of all the doctors in Russia are women, 70% of all the teachers, 40% of all the lawyers, and 30% of all the certified mechanical engineers. Russia, to the Russian, has been a land of opportunity. It has been a land of upward movement. It has been a movement which has satisfied the hopes and dreams of many. And so, though the average Russian, of course, has far less freedom than the average American, and though the average Russian has a standard of living below, way below that of the average of American,
It is nevertheless true that the average Russian has more social security and more educational opportunity than the average American who lives in Huff. And for the average Russian, knowing where he was 50 years ago, that is enough. Those who hope idly for some kind of populist revolution against those who now rule the Russian state, in my opinion, hope idly. Now, of course, there's a darker side to this picture. There is a dictatorship which is bloated and swollen and growing bigger by the day, which holds down efficiency. There is the inability of the Russian system to develop a democratic form of rule to break down the dictatorship of the proletariat. There is the constant uncertainty that the autocratic tyranny, the ruthless violence of the Stalinist period may not at some point reassert itself. Russia has not solved the critical problem of any government, the problem of succession. If the Russian people want to raise their standard of living rather than to give more arms to Nasser, knowing that Nasser jails the Communist Party, which they supposedly agree with, they have no way of protesting. If they want more butter, more bread, more cars, better clothing, and they're not so eager to put a man on the moon or to put a rocket beyond Venus, they have no way of protesting, no way of changing governmental policy. They have no alternative but to accept. The Russian poets, who in Russia occupy a central position in the literary world, they are, in a sense, the folk philosophers of Russia, complain about the banality of Russian life, complain about the puritanical quality, strangely about what they call the bourgeois mentality of Russian art and Russian literature. The writers complain about censorship. If a book is disapproved of, it is simply not published. No longer are men exiled to Siberia or killed. They are sentenced sometimes to jail for 6 months or a year. But the worst penalty for the author is simply to have his book relegated to his desk, remaining there unread by anyone. And that penalty is still exacted by a censorship which is erotic, which opposes eroticism, rather, which is episodic, and which precludes the completely free expression of criticism. Yet there is much criticism in the Soviet Union, and increasingly people feel free to criticize this or that act of productive decision, this or that act of governmental decision to visitors, or even in their own press. To a student of religion, the intriguing fact about Russian society today is that alongside the scripture, alongside Marx and Lenin, the holy revealed word, there has developed an intricate system of what we in our tradition call pilpul, hair-splitting legal analysis of the great texts, which allow those who are in control of the apparatus of the state to do exactly what they want, regardless of what the state, the classics maintain. Marx insisted on the collectivization of agriculture. One half of the agricultural output of the Russian society today comes from privately owned plots. Marx insisted that the profit motive must be completely taken out of the marketplace and out of industry. Increasingly, the economists such as Lieberman and Berman in the Soviet Union are demanding that the profit motive be reintroduced into the factory system, and they begin a very competent economic analysis with a long involved logical analysis of a sentence pulled out of context here, a phrase pulled out of context there from the scripture, to show that what they will prove economically was in fact what is insisted upon by Marx or by Lenin. The Russians have even made peace with the church, despite the anathemas hurled at the church by the early Marxist leaders. The church, as you remember, was the opiate of the masses. It was the propaganda means by which the privileged kept the ordinary in their place. Today, the Russian society is busy gilding again the beautiful onion-shaped domes of the old Russian Orthodox churches. The churches are open, the priests are free to offer the ritual, the people are free to come, and many are coming. All this, of course, within a church parish structure which is carefully controlled and run by the state itself. No Russian Orthodox priest would deliver a sermon on America such as I am delivering on Russia today. Only vis-a-vis the Jew does Russia maintain its intransigent opposition to religion. As you well know, some 500-600 small and medium-sized synagogues have been closed in a decade. The one yeshiva in Moscow has been closed. Synagogue worship is actively discouraged. There have been all kinds of niggling restrictions placed upon the Jewish community. They could not bake matzah for some years. They could not print the religious calendar, which tells them the dates of our holidays. They were not allowed to print a new edition of the prayer book, as the old books became fewer and fewer and more tattered and scattered. But this active opposition to the Jewish faith in more ways reveals the nature of Russian life today than it does reflect official Marxist doctrine. For in a sense, it says to us what is true throughout Russia, that Russia remains Russia, that Mother Russia, Tsarist Russia, in many ways is Mother Russia, Communist Russia. The tremendous outpouring of anti-Semitic feeling which existed in Tsarist Russia continues to exist in Communist Russia. The narrowness of the Russian society, which wants to isolate itself, has always wanted to isolate itself from other influences and other impulses from without, continues to be one of the dominating sociological aspects of communist society. And the Jew represents the alien, a humanistic tradition, a more Western tradition. The Jew remains a danger. And therefore, you maintain the pressure, the anti-religious pressure of communist doctrine vis-a-vis the Jew, though you do not maintain it vis-a-vis the Russian Orthodox or the Greek Orthodox or some of the Baptists and other Protestant groups which exist today within Russia. Russia is today essentially Russia, a strong, renascent, reborn Russia, eager throughout the world to reestablish her markets, to reestablish her military influence, to extend her authority as far as she can. And this renaissance of Russia faces the delegates who will congregate in Moscow with their most complex and difficult practical problem. Russia or communism? It is the same problem which the church faced 1,000 years ago. Is Rome the be-all and end-all, the focus and central aspect of Catholicism? Or has the Catholic Church interests which are different from, and in fact may be at war with, the interests of Rome? Russia has used the communist parties throughout the world very often to affect her own interests. And often those interests conflict with those of the international and of the coming, quotation marks, communist revolution. In the 1930s, when Hitler signed his pact with Stalin, Stalin, in effect, gave new authority to the man who had done more than any other man in Europe to blot out, to erase a communist party, to imprison its leaders, to throw them into concentration camps. For the sake of Russia, he had sacrificed the Communist Party in Germany. When his successors today give arms and aid to Nasser, in effect give arms and aid to a man who has imprisoned the small Communist Party in Egypt, and who will use these arms against Israel, the one nation in the Middle East, which allows the Communist Party to operate openly and tacitly and within the body structure. Russia demands that the Communist Party be the forerunner of her own interests. But the interests of communism vary at great degree from the interests of Mother Russia. And in the Orthodox Protestant battle, which is essentially the battle between Moscow and Peking, Peking is closer to the communist faith than Moscow is. Peking accuses Moscow of having sold out communism for Mother Russia, of having forgotten the world revolution because she has had her revolution and now she wants to protect what she has gained. In fact, she is afraid to venture out, to send out a crusade to convert the rest of the world. In the history of religions, there is a period of growth and of change. Religions are born in their solitariness, and their ideas appeal to a few, and they develop disciples, and the disciples preach the gospel. And then in some center of the world, some Constantine, some Lenin sees a way of using the gospel to arrogate power unto himself. And the faith is then bound inextricably with a place, a national interest. And inevitably, the faith and the interest of that place come into conflict. And there is a period within church structure of where the structure is decentralized, where there is a Protestant movement, where there is schism, and where there is what the Orthodox, those who control the apparatus of power, call heresy. And the Soviet Union and the Communist Party face exactly that situation today. The unity of the Communist Party has been shattered. It's shattered, I believe, irrevocably. Men maintain the faith, the pure faith, but is maintained neither in Moscow nor in Peking, but in little places throughout the world where men still dream of the proletarian revolution in its purity. Now, essentially, communism has become inextricably intertwined with various nationalisms, and these national interests predominate, overwhelm, and it is these which those who oppose the communist expansion must take into account. The days of simplistic, unified communism are over. Consequently, the days of unified, simplistic, anti-communist crusade also must be over. No longer is it a question of competing ideologies. Today, the political questions of the world are the questions of competing nationality, nationalisms, competing ambitions. No longer is it enough for us to proclaim we can give the worker all he needs and freedom, and for Russia to acclaim to the peoples of the world, we can give you the economic tools to move into power, and we will in time give the worker his freedom. That's not the issue in which the battle is being fought anymore. It's not being fought by priests, but by diplomats. It's not being fought by missionaries. It's being fought with guns, tanks, planes. And so it seems to me, as we take stock of this 50th anniversary of the Bolshevik, the Communist Revolution in Russia, we must be clearly aware of the simple fact that what began as a faith and have from the very beginning has showed all aspects of a world religion has in fact now suffered the critical illness of any great world religion when it allows itself to become one, identical, with some narrow political interest. There are still fanatic communists in the world, but by and large, a communist is simply a man with his particular economic attitude who is seeking to move his state from a lower level of gross national product to a higher level of gross national productivity, who is seeking to move it from a lower level of power to a higher rank of authority, a greater voice in the Council of Nations. And if we oppose expansion by any power, imperialism by any nation, then it is our responsibility no longer to fight this expansion in the ideological arena purely, but to fight it in the realistic arena, to understand what is involved, to understand that the world is no longer a divided world between two great faith systems, but it is a world filled with nations, each scrambling for its own ambitions, each problem demanding a separate and quite distinct remedy. In sum, what shall we say of 50 years of Soviet achievement? Could it have been achieved at a lesser price? I believe that it could have been. The bloodbath, which was Russia in the 30s, could have been avoided. Russia could have come as far as she had come under other than a tyrannical system. But that system has produced its own antidote. It has produced economic well-being. It has produced a sense of advantage over many of the emerging and or still not even emerging nations of the world. The Russian is proud of what he has, desirous of maintaining it, fearful of war and of the possible ravages of war to what he has gained with such cost. The Russian has his first taste of freedom, and the more sensitive in Russia are demanding more. Russia realizes that the real battles which she faces in the next years are domestic battles, battles to raise the standard of living, battles to raise the standard of culture, battles to raise the standard of decency, quality of things. And in that, her battles are not so much different than ours, her needs not so very different than those of the American people. Russia in 1917 was a have-not nation. Russia in 1967 is a have nation. The nations which have a responsibility, of course, to the nations which have not. But they are, and they can, because they no longer need to expand, to turn their people's ire away from their own problems. They have the possibility of making those political arrangements which offer some hope in our world of peace. The Russians speak of peace. They speak of the horrors of the 1940s. We don't want it again. We speak of peace. We see the horrors of nuclear war, and we don't want it for our children. Perhaps the two great nations of the world can somehow combine and forget for a moment the religious irrelevancies which set them apart and see the human responsibilities in which they have a common interest. Perhaps the areas of disarmament and trade, the areas of the reduction of world tensions, we can find in the years ahead some way to forge a world which will give the possibility of peace.